May it please the court, my name is Kylie Dunn, registration number 40638, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Esquivel. I'd like to focus on the first issue in my opening brief, which is whether the trial court erred in failing to suppress the statements that Mr. Esquivel made while he was seated in the back of the patrol car. A defendant's statements to police must be suppressed if the defendant was in custody at the time that he made the statements, if the statements were in response to interrogation, and if he did not exercise a valid waiver of his Miranda rights. Here it's undisputed that he was not given and did not waive his Miranda rights, and it's undisputed that the officer's questions amounted to interrogation. Therefore, the question for this court is whether Mr. Esquivel was in custody when he was seated in the back of the car. The standard is a defendant is in custody when a reasonable person in his position would have felt deprived of his freedom of action to the degree associated with a formal arrest. This encounter began as a traffic stop. The officer, Officer Idesness, saw the car that Mr. Esquivel was driving. He saw it weaving. He saw it fail to make a turn, and he decided to fail to signal a turn, and he decided to pull it over. Mr. Esquivel pulled into a gas station right by a gas pump. And the undisputed facts about all that happened after that established that this traffic stop evolved into a coercive and police-dominated atmosphere, and Mr. Esquivel was in custody at the time that he sat in the back of the car. So once Mr. Esquivel had pulled over, the officer went up to the window. He saw that Mr. Esquivel was indicating that he could not roll the window down, and so the officer opened the car door. The officer saw and smelt indicia of alcohol intoxication. He asked Mr. Esquivel for his license, registration, and proof of insurance, and Mr. Esquivel provided only a Colorado ID card. When the officer asked Mr. Esquivel whether there were other people in the car other than the front seat passenger, Mr. Esquivel said no. In fact, there were two other passengers in the back of the car. And the police officer asked those people for ID as well. He had checked the car's registration, and once he had everyone's ID, he determined that no one in the car was the owner of the car. And when he found out there were no keys, he started to suspect the vehicle was stolen. And at that point, he saw passengers reaching and digging around for something. It was the front seat passenger and the back seat passenger that sat behind the front seat passenger. Because of this observation, Officer Eisenhuss began to issue a series of orders that escalated this traffic stop into a custodial situation.
Is done. So yes. So it's at that point in time you're saying it's not the routine traffic stop, but now it's something more? I mean, is there a bright line, or is it totality of the circumstances?
Well, the standard is if under the totality of the circumstances, the defendant felt himself to be deprived of his freedom of action.
Is it a subjective test that the defendant felt himself to be deprived?
No, I may have just misstated that. It's a reasonable person in the defendant's position. To answer your question, though, my position is that at that point is when the traffic stop began to escalate, and that everything from that point forward turned it into a custodial situation. For the purposes of this analysis, though, he didn't make statements until he was seated in the back of the car. So I think you can take everything into account that happened up until the point that he was seated in the back of the car and interrogated. Once the officer saw the reaching and he was afraid for his safety, he asked them to put his hands, for everyone to put their hands where he could see them. He told Mr. Esquivel to remove the keys from the ignition. He told all four to stay in the car when he left. So he retreated to his car and he called for backup. Once backup arrived, he issued another order. He asked all of the individuals to get out of the car and walk back towards him. All of them were patted down, the weapons, and then they were told to go stand with the other officers who had arrived. At some point, Mr. Esquivel was placed in the back of the car, the patrol car, and that's the word that the trial court uses. The officer who testified at the hearing was unable to say with specificity how Mr. Esquivel came to be in the back of the car. At this, it's clearly a police-dominated atmosphere. There's two patrol cars now on scene. There's two uniformed officers, one in addition to the officer who did the stop. There's two plainclothes officers on the scene as well.
How many total cars on the scene? Police vehicles?
Four cars. Two marked cars and two unmarked cars.
Thank you.
And I think it's also important to note that one of these backup officers was watching the Mr. Esquivel's car as Officer Eidsness ordered them out of the car. The record's also clear that at the time that everyone was seated in the, so two people in the back of one marked car and two people in the back of the second marked car, both marked cars were being guarded by officers, watched by officers. The doors were closed but not latched.
Is the testimony that they were guarding the car?
There's testimony that they were watching the car, they were standing by the car. I can't recall the exact language. Mr. Esquivel's movements were severely limited throughout this encounter. I mean, he was ordered to do numerous things and he complied with those orders. Which culminated in him being placed in the back of the car. He was clearly not free to go during questioning. And at the time of questioning, he knew that he had committed the arrestable offense of driving with a license under revocation. And he told the officer that. He said, I think in response to the officer asked him about his driver's status because it hadn't come through dispatch yet. And Mr. Esquivel said, I'm a habitual traffic offender. That's what they arrested me for last time. While it is an objective test, a reasonable person in Mr. Esquivel's position, knowing that he was driving after revocation, would feel himself to be in custody.
Could you address either now or later in your argument why this wouldn't be harmless error?
Yes, I can. All of the statements that Mr. Esquivel made in the back of the car should be suppressed. There was statements related to alcohol use. He admitted to having drunk a couple of 40s previously in the day. He admitted that the 40 that, which is a 40 ounce alcoholic beverage, the 40 that was found in the car was his.
Oh, what significance?
The admission that he had had two 40s earlier in the day goes to the DUI.
What's the significance of the admission that the can rolling around in the back seat was his?
Well, I suppose it's not as significant as his admissions that he had been drinking. I believe there was some statement to the effect that he was going to drink it later. I think in general it just shows that he certainly was using alcohol that day continuously. And he also refused the voluntary roadside maneuvers when he was seen in the back of the car. And that refusal was used against him at trial, as were these statements. And the exact quotes are in my...
Pardon me. What's the significance of refusing blood alcohol tests? I mean, let's assume for a minute that he's in custody.
Right.
And he should have been given his Miranda rights.
Yes.
You're saying the police officer didn't have the right to ask him, which statutorily he can ask anyone, please do a roadside sobriety test, or you can have a blood alcohol test. Once he's under arrest, he can't ask that anymore?
No, he could ask that after he was under arrest, and I believe that in this case, he did ask him to do the chemical testing after he placed him under arrest. I'm referring to the request for the voluntary roadside maneuvers. Which he refused when he was seen.
And he couldn't, the officer can't do that. In this case, he couldn't do that without an advisement of rights?
I don't believe so. Then it can't be used against him at trial without him having been advised and waived of his rights.
His refusal to do it could not be used against him?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Yeah, no, is that conditioned only if he's in custody at the time, or if, say, it's a routine traffic stop and it's a DUI stop, and a police officer is asking someone to do roadside maneuvers and they refuse, is that ordinarily admissible or not?
Yes, that's ordinarily and routinely admissible. But in this case, he made the refusal at the time that he was in custody. So I think that it's distinguishable from those, your routine DUI type of case.
Can I ask you another question, too?
Yes.
Is I understand that the officer did tell Mr. Escobal, you are not in custody and you are free to leave. So what is the significance of that statement?
Well, the officer did tell him when he went back to the car, you're not under arrest. I'm not sure whether he used the words, you're free to leave. I think that's a factor that you can consider. But since it's a totality of the circumstances test, that's only one of these many circumstances that were surrounding this situation. And there's several cases I think I've cited in the reply brief where, despite the fact that they were told they're not in custody or told they're free to leave, the court nevertheless found that it was a custodial situation. And I think, in particular, the case that's coming to my head is People versus Mijares. And in that case, they noted that he was told he was free to leave, but then the officers either inadvertently or purposefully blocked the actual exit to the room at the hospital where they were interrogating him. That's similar to the case here where Mr. Escobar was seated in the back of the car, and the car was open, but the officer was standing, and I mean, presumably standing at some point where the door was open talking to him. So he couldn't actually get out of the car without being, I mean, the officer was standing right there.
I didn't mean to get us off track. I think we were starting to talk about harmless.
Yes. Yeah. This case, there's no chemical testing done in this case, which I think makes his statements and admissions to drinking all the more powerful evidence that was used against him. Also, he used profanity in refusing the test and in speaking with the officer, and that profanity was used against him explicitly at trial. The DA argued that, you know, this was not the act of, this kind of language would not have been used by someone who was not intoxicated. It's true that we stipulated to the HTO status at trial, but my position is that stipulation was made in light of the erroneous suppression hearing.
Is there no other evidence of the habitual traffic offender status?
I believe there was a driving record, and I can't recall right now, but I think the driving record did not come in as a result of our stipulation.
Because you stipulated it was not admitted
that's
into right. evidence?
That's my memory. And he also made statements about a gang affiliation. The court ultimately ruled those were inadmissible on evidentiary grounds, so those also didn't come in at trial.
Why does the stipulation, why doesn't that constitute a waiver then? I mean, you have your choice on how you're going to proceed in the case, and you can decide to maintain it the best case for your suppression motion, or you can go forward and make that stipulation. Why doesn't that stipulation constitute then a waiver of that particular issue?
Well, I think in talking about the harm that derives or comes from the suppression ruling, first of all, I don't think that we can parse out some statements would have been admissible and some statements wouldn't have been. I mean, all of these statements, it's undisputed, were made at the same time. So I don't think that it would be right to say that some could come in and some couldn't. I also think that, you know, the decision to stipulate perhaps was a strategic decision, but it's a strategic decision made in light of the knowledge that statement was going to come in. So I think that that's the appropriate way to analyze it.
Of course, if we get into those conditionals, then if you hadn't stipulated, then the documentary evidence would have come in and we end up on the slippery slope.
I think that's true. I think it's hard to predict what would have happened if the court had issued what I say is the correct ruling.
Go ahead.
I'm going to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Corral Spadigue, registration number 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. Turning to the defendant's first issue, the only one we seem to be addressing today, the people would agree that the only dispute is as to whether the defendant was in custody for Miranda purposes when he made the incriminating statements about having previously consumed a couple of 40s and being a habitual traffic offender. The law on custody is a two-part inquiry. So first, we need to consider the circumstances surrounding the interrogation. That's obviously the factual part. And then the court has to apply an objective test to resolve the ultimate legal inquiry, which is, given these factual circumstances, was there a formal arrest or restraint on the freedom of movement to the degree associated with a formal arrest? Some of the factors that we would consider are the time, place, and purpose of the encounter, the persons present, the words spoken by the officer's general tone and demeanor, the length and mood of the interrogation, whether any limitation of movement or form of restraint was placed on the defendant during the interrogation, response to questions, whether directions were given, and then verbal or nonverbal responses. So again, as judges have all pointed out, this is a totality of the circumstances kind of inquiry. We need to look pretty much from start to finish at how this all came to be. And I think when we look at the facts present here, in the context that it was present here, this was not the defendant was not in custody when he made the incriminating statements. So I'm going to go through this a little bit with you. Well, first, I want to highlight that this is a reasonable person standard, as we all have kind of agreed upon. So it depends on the objective circumstances and not the subjective unarticulated thoughts of either the defendant or the officer. Okay, so that's important. And as a general rule, routine traffic stops and roadside detentions do not constitute custody. So we need to differentiate between detention and custody, because those are two different ideas and different ideals. And while the defendant may have been detained here, he was not in custody.
And Ms. Pettigrew, would you agree this was not a routine traffic stop, or was there a point in time that it stopped being routine? Or?
Well, I think it escalated and came back down. What I wanted to say, so when he initially made the contact with the defendant, you know, he noticed the bloodshot eyes and the slurry speech and the alcohol in the breath. So at this point, he had the suspicion that he had been drinking, but, you know, we hadn't gone any further at that point. So little by little, some other, there's some more evidence that led to the officer being suspicious that maybe the car was stolen. You know, there was no key in the ignition at that point. No one knew who it belonged to or would admit who it belonged to. And the defendant, you know, could only produce a Colorado ID card. And so to the extent that the officer wasn't sure. Basically, there was a lot of question marks here, and the officer needed to conduct further investigation. Then at the point when the defendant, you know, for all intents and purposes, misstated or misrepresented how many people were in the car, the officer became concerned for his safety, because they were, you know, rustling around. They seemed to have be looking for something underneath the passenger, the front passenger seat. And at that point, he became concerned for his safety and that weapons may be present. And so in direct response to that, you know, stimuli, for lack of a better term, the officer said, okay, well, at this point, everyone put your hands where I can see them so that I can make sure that no one is, you know, looking for a weapon. And I think it's important to distinguish the fact that, you know, ordering them to put their hands on the dashboard and or on the seat in front of them and ordering them out of the car and to have a pat-down search was all explained by the officer as being in direct response to the fact that the defendant had misrepresented how many people were in the car and that they had been, you know, suspiciously moving about looking for what could have been weapons. And
so, why is that relevant to a reasonable person's perception of detention rising to the level of arrest? In other words, if we look through the telescope from the officer safety standpoint, this all makes sense. But if we look through it from the perspective of Mr. Esquibel, he didn't care about officer safety. He just is interested in whether he's free to leave. So what does the officer safety analysis have to do with it?
And I think that's a great question. I think the difference is that Officer Idness was explaining, as this all was happening, why he was conducting the pat-down search, why he was ordering them out of the vehicle. So as a reasonable person, you would say, okay, I'm not under arrest. He's just doing this because of officer safety, and he needs to make sure that we don't have weapons.
Is there any case that draws that distinction, that if the officer explains, I'm just doing this to protect myself, that changes the analysis?
Not that I know of specifically on that issue, but I think it would just speak to the reasonable person standard as to, you know, if you're being told why something is happening as opposed to just being ordered to do something and then ordered to walk back to the officers and ordered that you're having, you know, that you're going to be patted down. That, for a reasonable person, that might lead them to believe that they're under arrest or that, you know, that at that point things are getting more serious. But if it's explained to them, no, we're just doing this for this reason, and it was in direct result to, you know, in direct response to, you know, your behavior, and then I think a reasonable person can say, okay, that makes sense. You know, let's move forward.
Did the trial court make findings that there were explanations to the defendant that would help him understand what was going on, or did the court address that?
I think
that?
They did, and I think in its order it did note something about the defendant, or about the officer Ines having explained it, but I'm not positive, but I just read the order a little while ago, and I seem to remember something along those lines. I would note, speaking of case law, that, you know, there was, and I'm not positive if I cited it in my brief, but I believe that this court has found that officers who, you know, walked in to a home with guns drawn and then neutralized the home when they brought the defendant out later and questioned him on the curb, they had found that it was no longer a heightened level of police enforcement, and that it had, you know, been brought back down, and that it was no longer in custody at that point. And that was the Mulberry case, I believe. I can give you the site. So give me just a minute. People v. Mumford, 275 P3rd 667. And that was where, yeah, the police officers entered a home with their guns drawn, put them away after the home was cleared, and this was found to be fine under Miranda when the defendant was later questioned about the drugs found in his home. So to the extent that, you know, you can kind of bring down, I guess, the level of police, the enforcement level, the level of police presence for the defendant's reasonable person standard. I think that was done here, that if the police, Officer Ines explained why everything was happening, and then when the defendant was transferred to, it sounds like Officer Ines testified that they were asked to sit into the back of the police cars. Now, you know, we don't really know, because he wasn't actually the person who had the exchange with the defendant about moving to the cars, but it seemed that it was a consensual movement, and that the reason stated was the warm weather, the cars were parked in the shade, and that the traffic stop was taking place at a gas station where, in this particular gas station, had a, you know, a pretty good amount of foot traffic and car traffic, and so it was thought that maybe, you know, this whole thing taking place in the middle of this gas station was interfering with, you know, people walking by, cars walking by, it was a distraction. There was concerns about, you know, having too many people involved in the situation.
Was there any evidence in the suppression hearing or at trial that the movement into the back seat of the cars was by force as opposed to consensual?
No, I don't believe so. No.
My question was going to be the other side of that coin. Is there any indication in the record that the testifying officer actually knew either what was said to get the people in the back of the police cars, or knew why that instruction was given, or was he just speculating?
He was just speculating as to what he thought, why he thought the officers, he was searching the vehicle when the transfer was taking place.
So basically, he has no knowledge of what was said.
He was guessing as to why he thought his comrades had done that.
And if he was just guessing, then we would not give any weight to that testimony.
Okay. When the officer came, after the search had taken place, the officer came to speak with the defendant. He was sitting in the back of the car with another passenger. The doors were closed but not latched, so he could just push it open if he wanted to. He wasn't physically restrained in any way, no handcuffs, no officer was holding him back. When he was speaking with the defendant, he used a conversational tone. Again, he wasn't handcuffed. No threats were ever made against the defendant. He was sitting in the back with the other person. He didn't have his gun drawn or, you know, make any effort to subdue the defendant in any way. And the first thing he did, as Judge Lichtenstein noted, was ask him if he understood that he was not in custody and he was not under arrest. The defendant indicated that he understood. And then Officer Idness began asking him questions related to the traffic stop, asking him, you know, what's going on with his license? What's going on with, you know, have you been drinking today? That's when he made the comments about being a habitual traffic offender, having been arrested last time, and having consumed a couple of 40s previously. Now, up until that point, the arrestable information came at the point at which the defendant admitted to having, well, first when he said that he didn't want to take the roadside test, at that point that he could have been arrested. But all of the interrogation, all of the information that we're being contested to today came before that point, because that was the very last thing, basically, when Officer Idness said, okay, well, then this conversation is over. And as soon as that happened, he got the information from the DMV, you know, eliciting everything that he had been, you know, he was a habitual traffic offender, that he had the 24 prior restraints, et cetera, et cetera. So that's when he was arrested, at the point that he had tangible evidence that this defendant actually did commit these offenses, because the defendant was just kind of like, yeah, I am a habitual traffic offender. But he wasn't, when this interrogation was taking place, he didn't seem to be, you know, incriminating. Well, he was incriminating himself, but he wasn't. At that point, there was not an arrestable offense, because the DUI was a suspicion at that point. They hadn't done a breathalyzer. They didn't have a roadside test. It was just the bloodshot, watery eyes, the slurry speech, and the odor of alcohol. So once he declined the roadside test, at that point, the officer could arrest him.
And well, let me ask you, Ms. Fettigue, because you are drawing a line between whether it's an arrestable offense or not, and is that relevant, and if so, to what extent, to whether a person believes that their freedom of movement is restricted in a degree associated with that?
Well, it's just a factor, and it was one of the factors elicited in Knoll, one of the cases that the defendant relies on. And so to the degree that, you know, Knoll and Polander kind of state that if this defendant knew the entire time that he was going to be arrested and there was pretty much a certainty that he was going to be arrested that day, then it would be reasonable for a person to believe that this was not just a brief detention and that they weren't going to get to walk away from this. For the defendant, though, you know, he said statements like, you know, you ain't got nothing on me, and you ain't got nothing, and which would seem to indicate that he didn't think that he had done anything wrong, and or that nothing that would be arrestable they could take him away for. And so I think that's just another factor in the totality of the circumstances to consider in terms of, you know, was it arrestable? At what point did it become arrestable? And were his incriminating statements made before that point?
Would you also address harmless error?
I would. We would argue that even if these statements were incorrectly if they were incorrectly prohibited from entering into the trial, or were admitted at trial, the DWA charge, the prosecution called an expert in toxicology and the effects of human alcohol on the human body to testify to the existence of certain symptoms when a person consumes alcohol, all of which were the symptoms exhibited by the defendant. This, coupled with Officer Idness' testimony about, you know, his bloodshot, watery eyes, his inability to, he exhibited some unsteadiness apparently when he got out of the car, and the alcohol emitting from his breath, his swaying, et cetera, all of those things together, I think, would have resulted in a DWA charge or DWA conviction, regardless of, you know, his admission of having consumed 240s prior to driving.
Do we look at whether the other evidence would have been sufficient to establish the offense, or do we look at whether the admission of statements, that the verdict was truly unattributable to the admission of
the
statements?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, where whether his statements would have contributed to his guilty verdict. You know, I'm saying that I believe, I'm sure they contribute. Well, I say that they don't, because what happened was, you know, with this expert testimony coupled with Officer Idness's testimony, I think those were the crux of the state's case, being that they believed that the defendant was intoxicated at the time he was driving the vehicle.
About Ms. Dunn's argument that on the HTO charge, that you couldn't have proved the HTO charge absent the stipulation. You didn't prove it.
Well, like you noted, Judge Carper, I believe that, you know, the state was, you know, this is a difficult position to argue, because had he not stipulated, then surely the state would have provided additional evidence in support of that charge. Would I agree that the stipulation was, you know, the main evidence? Absolutely. Why would you admit additional evidence if you have a stipulation from the defendant? So it's kind of a chicken or the egg argument on that one, unfortunately. It looks like my time is up. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that they affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Okay, I have several brief points. First, in response to the question about whether or not there's any case law regarding whether explanations that you're not in under arrest are sufficient, I want to direct the court to People v. Magnum, which is 48 P3D 568. And there, the defendant was told he was not under arrest and that he had been handcuffed for his own protection. And nevertheless, the court there found that he was in custody for the purposes of a Miranda analysis.
Is it a factor under the totality of the circumstances that we can consider?
Certainly, you can consider what he was told, but I don't think it's in any way determinative. And I see my time is up if there's no further questions.
I'd welcome your other comments.
Oh, okay. Secondly, I was just going to say in response to the reliance on Mumford versus the people, where the police arrived with guns drawn and they ultimately found that the defendant Mumford, who was on the curb outside, was not in custody. I believe the court relied, at least in part, on the fact that the defendant knew, and a reasonable person in his position also would have known, that the arrest warrant and the search warrant were actually for his roommate, not for him. And that was found to be an important part of the analysis in finding that once he was sitting on the curb, yes, it had de-escalated, and he wasn't the focus of the investigation from the beginning, and he knew it. Thirdly, just finally, a little bit in response to the harmless, the argument this was not harmless, this court cannot find that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I just want to highlight that, you know, he was charged with DUI and the jury convicted him of DWAI. So certainly they were not overwhelmed by evidence that he was intoxicated and they chose to convict on the lesser. And I believe if there's no further questions, that's all I have.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.